Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, August 1, 2020. Crime: 5 nurses charged in inmates' death at jail, by Caitlin Randall. See Randall at MRT.com. The Midland County Sheriff's Office and District Attorney's Office reported the arrests of 3 additional nurses Friday afternoon, bringing the total to 5 who have been charged in connection with the death of an inmate at the Midland County Jail in July 2019. Adeola Adesomi, Lillian O'Carey, Kelly Robbins, Timothy Forbush Jr., and Flor Estrada have been charged with criminally negligent homicide, manslaughter, and tampering with a government record, according to a joint press release from Sheriff David Kreiner and District Attorney Laura Noldolf. A grand jury returned indictments for the individuals on July 15, following a year-long investigation by the Texas Rangers, the release states. The inmate, 30-year-old Savion Hall, was arrested on June 21, 2019, for an alcohol or drug offense, according to a custodial death report filed with the Texas Attorney General's office. He died July 19, 2019, a week after he was transferred to the hospital because of low oxygen levels. Hall had a known medical condition that affected his breathing and was receiving breathing treatments, according to the custodial death report. Estrada was the first to be arrested, and a copy of her indictment was obtained by the Reporter-Telegram on Friday morning. Estrada allegedly failed to maintain proper medical records pertaining to Hall's treatment, resulting in his death, her indictment states. She also allegedly made a false entry on Hall's treatment flow sheet, which would detail the date and time of any drugs administered. Hall was receiving a nebulizer treatment, according to Estrada's indictment, but it does not specify what drug he was receiving or provide information about his illness. Copies of the other individuals' indictments were not yet available Friday afternoon. Estrada, Forbush, and Robbins are being held at the county jail on $250,000 bond. Bond information for the others was not yet available. All 5 were contracted nurses and not county employees, according to Nodolf. Good Steward. Local BBBS Board President wins National Award, by J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hearstmp.com. Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America has honored a Midlander for her service to the organization. Diane McClellan, President of the Board of Big Brothers, Big Sisters of the Permian Basin, has received the Janice and Bill Hanna Good Steward Award, which recognizes someone who gives of their time, talent, and treasure, said Kay Kreitz, Executive Director. McClellan, who has been president for 2 years and has been on the board for 5 years, was selected from nominees of more than 240 agencies in the Big Brothers Big Sisters network. She said she started volunteering with the nonprofit as a big sister and has donated to the organization since she moved to Midland. Her late husband, Dan, also used to volunteer with BBBS and had attended a fundraising bachelor auction that she also had attended. Years later, they figured out that they were at the same event when they were going through pictures. McClellan got involved with the board after her husband died because she wanted to do more than write checks. The couple made a yearly donation to BBBS. Every year I would do my donation checks, and then I sent an email to Kay and asked if there was something else I could be doing besides writing a check every year, she said. The first year she was on the board, McClellan said she almost quit because she didn't think she could contribute like the younger members who were all in the workforce and had social networks set up. Kreitz convinced McClellan to stay on the board to help guide them and nominated McClellan for the award. Kreitz said McClellan has paid or helped pay to attend conferences and has missed only 3 board meetings since she started on the board. She's chaired events, and if she didn't chair them, she attended and helped set up, Kreitz said. She has just been there. She's been at every board retreat, and as far as giving her time, she has set the example. In giving, she is one of our top donors every year. Kreitz said the board is following example McClellan sets by her presence and attitude toward the organization. McLellan also donates her time as a school-based big sister. It has been a challenge because they have had to visit over FaceTime since the pandemic began. Her little sister is a 9-year-old who was in third grade last academic year. I would visit with her an hour a week, and I think that does really make a difference. But the people at the school were so appreciative of the fact that I would come and be with her, McLellan said. You don't go really to work with her, as far as schoolwork goes, but instead to just listen and encourage her. McLellan said she will miss being on the board when she has to leave next year, but is eligible to return after sitting out a year. Rig count ends 20 weeks of declines. U.S. tally remains unchanged at 251. Texas adds rig. By Mella McEwen. mmcewen at mrt.com. The U.S. rig count ended 20 weeks of declines, with Baker Hughes reporting Friday that the nation's tally stood at 251, unchanged from the previous week. That tally is the lowest on record since the Oil Field Services Company began keeping records in 1944. It is down 679 rigs from the 918 reported at work in the U.S. at this time last year. Texas reported the addition of one rig, putting 104 at work within the state. Oklahoma joined its southern neighbor as the only producing state to gain, adding one rig for a total of 11. New Mexico lost two rigs and stands at 49. The Permian Basin, with about half of the nation's rigs, fell another two rigs to 124. That compares to 442 rigs at work in the Permian a year ago, a difference of 318. Eddy County, New Mexico, remains the most active county in the Permian with 28 rigs, down one from last week. Lee County, New Mexico, followed with 21, down one from the previous week. Loving County, Martin County, and Midland County each recorded 13 rigs at work within county lines this week, up one for Martin County and unchanged for Loving and Midland counties. Reeves County had 11 rigs, unchanged. Upton County went from 10 rigs to 9 this week. Ward County lost its one active rig, while Yoakum County saw renewed activity with one rig at work this week. The longer-term trend is one of declining industry employees and rigs. It simply takes fewer employees and lower numbers of working rigs to produce record amounts of crude oil, and that trend will only be magnified going forward, said Carr Ingham, petroleum economist with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, during a virtual press conference discussing the Alliance's Texas Petro Index for the first half of 2020. Meanwhile, there's a trough out there, somewhere, and for the rig count, that is probably very soon. I think the rig count is about to hit bottom, and we will begin to stand up a few rigs here and there. Energy. Crude prices hold above $40 for week. By Mella McEwen. mmcewen at mrt.com. Crude prices lost some ground this week, but managed to hold above the $40 range. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange added 35 cents, or just under 1%, to close at $40.27 a barrel Friday. Prices were down from Monday's close of $41.60 a barrel. The posted price ended the week at $36.75 a barrel. The futures price had fallen below $40 Thursday, closing at $39.92 for the first time in several weeks. Natural gas prices ended higher, though they lost ground from Wednesday, when the new near-month September contract closed at $1.889 per MCF. Prices lost 3 cents to end the week at $1.799 Friday, up from $1.734 Monday, though that was still the August delivery contract. Shale is in for a tough time. Not quite as tough as 3 months ago, Dan Juergen, vice chairman of IHS Market, said in a phone interview. It will take a year or so for the industry to heal, he said. A lot will depend on the COVID-19 virus and its impact on the economy. Carr Ingham, petroleum economist with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, said in an email to the Reporter-Telegram, there seems to be little doubt that this will be a choppy process going forward in terms of COVID and its relationship to the general economy, and therefore to energy demand. Prices are now and always a function of demand relative to supply, and uncertainties abound on both sides, COVID, and economic conditions, stalling what has been fairly steady and impressive demand improvement since April, and questions about OPEC Plus and whether they will follow through with the addition of 2 million barrels per day from the cuts they currently have in place. And they seem to indicate they would consider doing so on the notion that steady demand improvement continued. So, I don't expect crude oil prices to go higher in the next month or two, and could go lower if the COVID news remains bad or worsens. OPEC Plus will have a lot to say about that as well. If demand does improve from where it is now, generally speaking, it is certainly possible the global demand figure could go higher than the global production figure, and that would push prices upward at some point in the late third quarter, possibly fourth quarter. But that is wholly dependent on continued demand recovery, and that in turn is wholly dependent on COVID and OPEC Plus. All in all, however, I still think $40 oil at this stage of the game is encouraging, and it is a better, faster outcome than we might have thought back in April. Amid the low price levels, Ingham wrote in his email, energy companies have managed to significantly lower their break-even costs. All industries and firms in those industries endeavor to become more efficient and productive over time, and to increase productivity while lowering costs at the same time. So this is not a phenomenon unique to the oil and gas industry. However, it is very pronounced within the upstream oil and gas industry, and we have watched it happen in a relatively short span of time, economically speaking. These advancements in technology, at least in the observable sense, date back to the early part of the 2000s as horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing were widely deployed to crack open vast new amounts of natural gas supply, first in the Barnett Shale and then beyond. After the recession of 2008-2009, those technologies were much more widely deployed for crude oil production. And that is, of course, what led to the establishment of the Eagle Ford Shale as a major national production region, when there was scarcely a barrel of oil produced in the Eagle Ford up to 2008 or so. Even at that, productivity and efficiency gains in the Permian were a little later in coming, and it took from post-recession 2010 through 2014 for Permian crude oil production to start posting 20%-ish year-over-year increases, Ingham continued. As those numbers began to skyrocket in the Permian and statewide, a couple of things began to become apparent. First, after peaking in late 2014 at over 465, and after the 2014 through 2016 downturn, the rig count in the ensuing recovery, 2016 through 2020, never got anywhere near that number again, averaging as high as only about 390 in October 2018 for RRC districts 7C, 8, and 8A. In Texas statewide, the rig count in late 2014 was over 900 rigs, and reached only as high as 533 monthly averages in October and November 2018. The rig count began to decline and continued to do so all throughout 2019. And yet, even as the rig count was lower and statewide industry employment numbers were lower, crude oil production continued to increase dramatically, setting all manner of new records along the way, finally peaking at over 5.4 million BPD statewide in March 2020. Ingham said statewide industry employment peaked at nearly 300,000 jobs in December 2014. Following the downturn in 2014-2016, direct industry employment statewide reached only as high as 228,500 in December 2018, and has declined steadily since then, and very sharply since February of this year. And yet crude oil production continued to increase. Clearly, the number of employees and rigs required to produce a barrel of oil came down steadily and significantly post-2016. And put another way, the number of barrels produced per rig and employee went dramatically higher. He said these phenomena point to increased productivity at lower costs. The industry has simply perfected these techniques, and as they have matured, they have become much less expensive to employ, requiring fewer resources in terms of labor and equipment, which by definition means lower costs. Other cost savings occur as well, but these are among the most evident. So, Ingham said, it should be expected that productivity and efficiency increase over time, and costs decrease over time. Again, for all industries, and there's no reason oil and gas should be an exception. So, while it should come as no surprise, it is still quite stunning to observe just by watching the data trends over the last 10 to 20 years, and the last five in particular. Simply put, the industry has accomplished extraordinary things in recent years, all to the benefit of the American, and global for that matter, consumer, for which the U.S. oil and gas industry, clearly led by Texas, has established a long-term, abundant, affordable supply of energy for literally decades to come. Does that come at the expense of jobs and other measures of upstream activity? Clearly it does. But again, this is not remotely unique to the oil and gas industry. And as those jobs are lost, other jobs are created elsewhere in the economy. That is the very essence of economic progress over time. Ingham said that while statewide industry employment has declined over time, and not just related to the current circumstances, Midland-Odessa direct oil and gas employment actually continued to rise through year-end 2018, surpassing previous records, before leveling off and losing a few jobs in 2019, before the coronavirus pandemic hit. Volunteer marks 25 years with Recording Library by Christopher Hadern. See Hadern at MRT.com. Reading out loud was a task that Dorothy Blair took joy from when she worked as a first and third grade teacher at Fannin Elementary School from 1974 to the mid-1990s. So, when Blair retired from teaching after a 38-year career, there was a void in her life. It only seemed natural that she would start volunteering with the Recording Library of West Texas, where she recorded audiobooks beginning August 15, 1995. I taught elementary school, and I was retiring, and I wanted to volunteer to do something, Blair said. I don't know if someone mentioned it to me, but I loved reading to my children at school, and of course my children at home, too. The Recording Library of West Texas brings the world of literature and print media to people who have difficulty because of blindness, other vision problems, or have trouble reading. Blair said she records mainly audio files of books by Texas authors, but she also reads newspapers, Bible class lessons, and issues of Texas Monthly. It takes about 2 months to read an entire book and record it on tape, she said. Her favorite recording is a children's book, Hank the Cow Dog. If you've never read Hank the Cow Dog, you need to read Hank, Blair said. He's the chief caretaker of the ranch. Literacy is an issue that is important to Blair, who was involved in Reading Recovery, a program that helps first grade students who have difficulty reading. I love to read, Blair said. I want people to enjoy reading. During her time with the Recording Library, Blair said washed is the word she has had the most trouble with. She used to pronounce the word washed. I can't get away from that Texas accent, she said. When she first started at the Recording Library, it was located across the street from Midland High School on property that is currently owned by First Presbyterian Church. The nonprofit now is at the MSS building on A Street. Bailey Hennis, the Recording Library's executive director, said Blair conducted her first recordings on a reel-to-reel audio tape machine. It's changed very much since I first started because when I first began, there was somebody inside the booth reading and there was a person outside the booth monitoring what you were reading, Blair said. So if you made a mistake, you immediately stopped and you and the monitor went back and made the corrections. It's changed a lot because now we are in a booth by ourselves and it's all talking to the screen. A ceremony had been planned to celebrate Blair's 25th anniversary, but it has been canceled because of the COVID-19 pandemic. To commemorate the occasion, Recording Library of West Texas plans to send her flowers, Hennis said. Blair hasn't gone to the studio in over 3 months because of the pandemic, but hopes to volunteer again soon. I have always loved it, Blair said. I love the people that I work with. They are so good to the volunteers, and I've just had a very good experience. I have loved every minute of it. Follow Christopher on Twitter at Chris_MRT Sports. Midlander Dorothy Blair said she has loved every minute of the time spent volunteering for the Recording Library of West Texas. Reading Incentive. Midland County Public Library on Wednesday hosted two performances by local children's entertainer Harlan Rhodes at the Horseshoe. More than 50 people attended the shows, which were part of the library's annual summer reading program event schedule. The program encourages reading and helps to prevent or lessen the loss of reading skills many students experience over summer break. MCPL offers incentives, prizes, and special performances throughout the summer. Participants who complete the program will be entered into a drawing to win one of 9 new bicycles. Names of the winners will be drawn during a Facebook Live event on Friday, according to a library spokeswoman. Program events and incentives are made possible by the Midland County Public Library Foundation and Midland Friends of Libraries and Literacy. City: SWAT uses gas to force man from apartment. From staff reports. A 42-year-old Midland man was being held in Midland County Jail Friday after barricading himself in an apartment and refusing to let a woman leave, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. Basilio Mendoza was charged with felony unlawful restraint, a third-degree felony, and resisting arrest, a Class A misdemeanor. Bond has not been set on the felony. A $500 bond has been set for the misdemeanor. Midland Police Department responded to a noise complaint in the 3600 block of North Midland Drive at about 1:15 a.m. Friday. They found a man beating on a wall with a hammer. He became agitated when he saw officers arrive and antagonized the officers as they approached the apartment, according to the release. The man, later identified as Mendoza, then barricaded himself in the apartment. He had a large knife in addition to the hammer, according to the release. Shortly after officers arrived, an elderly woman tried to leave the apartment, but Mendoza refused to let her leave, according to the release. MPD's SWAT team and negotiators were called to the scene. The woman was evacuated safely, and then SWAT deployed 2 rounds of gas into the apartment, according to the release. Mendoza exited the apartment and was taken into custody. Coronavirus fatalities rises by 2 to 42, by Stuart Doreen. S. Doreen at HearstMP.com. Another 2 Midland County residents died Friday after bouts with coronavirus, bringing the total to 42, according to the City of Midland. The 41st and 42nd deaths were a man in his 70s and a woman in her 50s. Both were being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. The Midland Health Department also reported another 64 confirmed coronavirus cases in the county. The new cases Friday bring the total this week to 372 and the total during the pandemic to 2,179. The Health Department also reports there have been 1,184 recoveries, 727 currently self-isolating cases, 93 under investigation, 133 listed as unable to locate, refused. Price drop in Midland's gas price is triple state average, by Stuart Doreen, S. Doreen at HearstMP.com. The average price of gas dropped across the state, and even more so in Midland. AAA Texas reported a 1 cent drop in the average price statewide. However, the drop was triple in Midland and even greater in Odessa, 5 cents. Still, Midland and Odessa are among the 3 cities with the highest average prices in the state. El Paso finished first this week with an average of $2.13 a gallon. Odessa was again second at $2.06 and Midland third at $2.04. Those are the only metropolitan areas among the largest 27 in the state with averages at or above $2. The average across the state was $1.89, according to the organization. AAA Texas also reported that drivers in Texas are paying some of the cheapest prices at the pump, ranking third lowest in the country. We are entering the final weeks of the summer driving season, and drivers around Texas are still paying under $2 a gallon on average, AAA Texas spokesman Joshua Zuber stated in a press release. Pump prices may continue to push downward as COVID-19 concerns persist, excluding any major interruptions such as significant tropical weather in the Gulf of Mexico. Across the region, the following averages were reported: $1.80 in Lubbock, a decrease of 3 cents; $1.79 in Amarillo, a decrease of 5 cents; $1.86 in Abilene, a decrease of 1 cent; and $1.87 in San Angelo, a decrease of 2 cents. The decline in El Paso was 2 cents. The lowest price in the state was $1.78 in San Antonio, according to AAA Texas. The difference in the average price between Midland, Odessa, and across the state actually decreased this week. The report from AAA Texas showed the difference this week was 17 cents in Odessa and 15 cents in Midland. Distributors have told the Reporter-Telegram there are many complexities in the fuel business that impact pricing. They pointed to the high cost of transportation from Gulf Coast refineries and Midland's distance from pipelines. Drivers in Midland are paying 61 cents less than during the same time last year. The average across the state is down 69 cents year over year. Average gas prices. This week, El Paso, $2.13, Odessa, $2.06, Midland, $2.04, Corpus Christi, $1.94, Brownsville, Harlingen, $1.92, state average, $1.89, national average, $2.19. Last week, El Paso, $2.15, Odessa, $2.11, Midland, $2.07, Corpus Christi, $1.98, Brownsville, Harlingen, $1.97, state average, $1.90, national average, $2.19. Source, AAA Texas. Habitat, still at work. Midland Habitat for Humanity dedicated a home at 811 Discovery Court for Ashley Grant, center, and her three sons, 7 months old, left, 18 months old, right, and 14, not pictured. Participating in the ceremony, which was July 16, were representatives of the home's sponsors, Lael Cordes Pitts with the Henry Foundation, left, and Lacey Sperry with Anadarko Petroleum. Donating gifts in kind for construction of the house were Acme Brick, Cherokee Rental, City of Midland, Dow Chemical, Hunter Douglas, Friends of the Library, Midland Quilters Guild, Permian Basin Needle Arts Chapter of Embroiderers Guild of America, Valspar Paint, Whirlpool Appliances, Yale Lock, M&M Disposal, ASCO, and United Rentals. Obituaries. Efren Marez. Efren Marez, loving husband, father, and grandfather, began his eternal life with our Heavenly Father on July 28, 2020. He was born September 2, 1948, in Zacatecas, Mexico. As a young entrepreneur, he moved to Midland, Texas to start his own business specializing in flooring installation services. He devoted his life to his family and work and enjoyed spending time with his children and grandchildren. He instilled in his children to always do the right thing, be a good person, and give an honest effort in all that they do. Efren is survived by his wife of 34 years, Petra Marez, three children from his first marriage, Cecilia Marez, Amador Marez, and Ubaldo Marez, four children he gained and fathered from Petra's first marriage, Anthony Bermea, Yolanda Horton, Felix Bermea, and Michael Bermea, and a daughter they had together, Sally Marquez. His sisters, Graciela, Graciana, and Griselda, and many grandchildren. Efren is reunited with his father, Efren Marez, Sr., mother, Jovita Esquivel Marez, brother Carlos Marez, and three children from his first marriage, Lucy, Lupita, and Lupe. Funeral service will be held Tuesday, August 4, 2020, at 12 p.m. in the chapel of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, with burial to follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Pallbearers, Amador Marez, Ubaldo Marez, Anthony Bermea, Alex Marez, Javier Marquez II, and Javier Marquez III. Our family would like to extend our appreciation for all the thoughts and prayers during this difficult time. Goodbyes are not forever. Goodbyes are not the end. They simply mean, I will miss you until we meet again. We love you, Dad. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Matthew 5:4. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Manuel B. Lada. Manuel B. Lada of Midland died Wednesday, July 29, 2020, at the age of 87. He will be greatly missed by his family. Manuel was born in Casa de Piedra, Texas, and raised in Marfa, Texas. He proudly served in the United States Army. After the Army, he married Bertha Lotta and lived in Midland, Texas to raise 7 children. He is survived by his wife, Bertha Lotta, his sons, Manuel Lotta Jr. and Jesse Lotta, his daughters, Yolanda Gonzalez, Carol Cervantes, Mary Lotta, and Sylvia Morris, and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his son, Antonio Lotta. Rosary and viewing will be Friday at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Funeral services will be Saturday at 2 p.m. at San Miguel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Funeral Mass is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Death Notices. Loretta Merchant Lunsford. Loretta Merchant Lunsford, 81, of Midland, passed away on Sunday, July 26, 2020. Family will receive friends for visitation on Sunday, August 2, 2020, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral service is set for Monday, August 3, 2020, at 2 p.m. at Fairmont Park Church of Christ, 3813 Midland Drive, Midland, Texas. Burial will follow to Serenity Memorial Gardens. She is survived by her husband, Burl Lunsford, 3 sons, Jimmy Burl Lunsford, Michael Wayne Lunsford, and Anthony Scott Lunsford, 1 brother, 1 sister, and 5 grandchildren. Robert Jones. Robert Jones, 79, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Wednesday, July 29, 2020. A visitation will take place from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday, August 2, 2020, at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. on Monday, August 3, 2020, at Stonegate Fellowship. A burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, August 1st, 2020. Section A. City Council and Mayor Filings Roll In by Michael Merlot. November's city elections filings are rolling in as a number of Odessans have filed for the city's top elected slots. As of Friday, multiple people have filed for city council positions as others continue to work through the process before the 5 p.m. deadline, August 17th, to file to hold city office. 5 candidates have already filed for different seats, including the mayoral seat. Denise Swanner filed for the at-large position currently held by Peggy Dean, who is not seeking a second term. Swanner detailed she has lived in the area her whole life and currently works as an administrator. Joanne Davenport Littleton also filed for the at-large position, and her application shows that she has lived in the area for 40 years, and she listed housewife as her occupation. Davenport lost a bid for the District 1 seat in 2016 to former Councilman Malcolm Hamilton, who resigned from the seat this year. Davenport held the District 1 seat from 1990 to 1998. Eddie Mitchell is the only candidate who has filed for the District 1 position so far, and his application shows he has lived in the district for 22 years and is self-employed. That seat is currently held by Michael Shelton Sr. He was appointed to the seat in April following Hamilton's abrupt resignation. The District 2 seat, which is currently held by Dewey Bryant, has one candidate so far, Stephen Thompson. His applications detail he is retired and that he has lived in the district for 5 years. Bryant, who will have termed out of his position this year, is the only candidate who has filed for mayor to replace David Turner, who has also termed out of his position. Bryant has reportedly lived in the area for 26 years and listed his occupation as a bank CEO. Others reportedly running for seats have until the deadline to finish required petitions, which consist of gathering 50 registered voter signatures in the area in which their position is sought, or any Odessa registered voter for mayor or at large. Election day is November 3rd. Man steals OPD unit, ends in officer-involved shooting. The Odessa Police Department stated in a press release that a man stole a squad unit Thursday night that led to a high-speed chase and an eventual officer-involved shooting in West Odessa. OPD spokesperson Corporal Steve Lesser stated via text message Friday afternoon that any questions about the officer-involved shooting, including the name of the man who was reportedly arrested, should be directed to Texas Department of Public Safety spokesperson Sergeant Oscar Villarreal. On Friday morning, Villarreal said over the phone that the Texas Rangers were investigating the shooting portion of the incident. The events prior to the officer-involved shooting will be investigated by OPD. The Odessa American remains involved in a lawsuit with the city of Odessa for refusing to release public information in a timely manner. The name of the man is a public record and should be released. Lesser said over the phone Friday morning the man was transported to a local hospital after he was grazed during the officer-involved shooting with non-life-threatening injuries. Lesser also said no officers were injured during the multiple incidents. The reported events started around 8 p.m. Thursday when OPD officers were conducting a narcotics investigation and the man evaded officers in a dark-colored SUV, an OPD press release detailed. Officers located the vehicle at I-20 and Meadow, where the vehicle appeared to be stalled. Officers were reportedly in the area looking for the man when an OPD unit was stolen and driven away by the man police were seeking. The OPD unit and the man were located wrecked out at West 18th and Moss. OPD officers fired their duty weapons at the man. Neither the press release provided by OPD or further questions to Lesser detail if the man fired shots at the officers. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, confirmed and probable, 3,287. Ector County negative, 13,141 out of 16,758 tested, with 330 pending, 49 deaths. Recovered, 2,318. Active, 920. Midland County, 2,179 confirmed, 43 deaths. Texas, 420,946 confirmed, with 3,669,752 tested. Total Texas deaths, 6,569. U.S. cases, 4,405,932 total confirmed, and 150,283 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or on the CDC website at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. MCH reports 33rd and 34th COVID-19 related deaths. Medical Center Hospital reported two more COVID-19 related deaths Friday. A Friday MCH press release detailed that a 91-year-old man from Presidio died Friday morning. He was reportedly admitted to MCH July 28th. The second patient was a 75-year-old man who died Friday afternoon. He was from Odessa and was admitted to MCH July 19th. Both men reportedly had pre-existing conditions. MCH detailed that 36 COVID-19 positive patients are in the hospital. 15 patients are in the CCU, 7 are on ventilators, and 21 are on the COVID isolation floors, 7 central and 8 central. Quick hits. Online webinar. Odessa Lynx has scheduled the 7th annual community online webinar, Resiliency, Transforming Trauma into Healing, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. August 20th. Guest speakers will be Dr. Karen Alter-Reed, Chandra Quintanar, and H. Reese Butler. The webinar is free. Sponsorship is available. To sponsor or for more information, call 582-0099, email linksconference@gmail.com, or visit tinyurl.com/Y5Q9LGFK. Obituary and death notice for Saturday, August 1st. Valerie Diane Noe. Valerie Diane Johnston Noe, 67, of Brownwood, passed away Tuesday, July 28th. A come-and-go visitation from 2 to 4 p.m. will be held at the Austin Avenue Church of Christ in Brownwood, Sunday, August 2nd. Valerie was born August 8, 1952, in Abilene, to Bill and Betty Johnston. She married James Jim Noe in 1973. Valerie is survived by her husband Jim of Brownwood, son Matt and wife Andrea of Brownwood, daughter Melissa and husband Eric Clay of Dallas, her mother Betty Johnston of Odessa, sister Carol Emmons of Odessa, and 5 grandchildren, along with many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her father, Bill Johnston, and her brother, Lyle Johnston. Donations in lieu of flowers can be made to Cherokee Home for Children, Post Office Box 295, Cherokee, Texas, 76832. Condolences, tributes, and memorials can be shared with the family at www.heartlandfuneralhome.net. Death notice. Ennis Edna Baker. Ennis Edna Baker, 88, of Odessa, died Saturday, July 25th. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. August 4th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, August 2nd, 2020, Section A, a commentary by Mayor Patrick Payton. If we had do-over, school wouldn't be named Lee. As I write this op-ed, we are all deeply aware of the stress and strain at every turn of life we share. Economic, physical and social unrest fill our daily lives with no end in sight. And now, the social dynamics have come closer to home than we might have expected, but which we must deal with just like we are dealing with economic and health-related challenges. I am keenly aware of the tension, anxiety, and even anger in the discussion about the renaming of Robert E. Lee schools. Like so many of you, I share a familial and emotional attachment with Lee Schools. I served as the chaplain for the Lee Rebels football team, watched all my kids wear the maroon, silver, and white, and compete in extracurricular activities, and yes, I even got kicked out of a game for yelling at the ref, a memory not worth keeping. Nevertheless, memories, attachments, and accomplishments are not what is at stake in the change we are discussing. I would suggest that doing what is right is what is at stake in this moment of our time. Allow me to invite you to consider a scenario that might help frame or even reframe this moment in our shared history. Imagine it's 2019. Yes, I'm taking you backward in time. And there is only one high school in Midland. Due to the growth of our community, the time has come to build a new high school. It's time to be a two-high school town. As the new school is being completed, a committee is convened to name this new school. Do you and I think that this 2019 committee would choose to name a brand new high school Robert E. Lee High and choose as the mascot a caricature of General Lee, possibly a rebel flag, and a fight song called Dixie? I already know defenses are rising up in the reading of this paragraph, so please answer the question in the context I am describing for you. If you and I will think in the context in which we live, here are a few reasons we would not name our fictional new school after a Confederate general. By the 21st century, we are no longer protesting a landmark Supreme Court case that mandated desegregation in public schools. In fact, through our study of history, we would know that throughout a segment of our country in the late 1950s and early 60s, many Southern state school boards named schools after Confederate leaders just to spite the right movement of history towards desegregation. We would not choose Robert E. Lee because it would represent something we no longer value, segregation, and the exaltation of the 19th century Southern states that rose up to protect the right to own slaves. By the 21st century, we would choose against the name Robert E. Lee because we have learned that right up to the late 60s, our black brothers and sisters, as well as Asian and Hispanic, read the following on deeds of homes right here in Midland, words rooted in a Southern war history intent on protecting the right to own slaves. Quote, "No premises or lots or parts thereof shall ever be used or conveyed to any person of any race or descent other than persons of the Caucasian race, provided, however, that this restriction shall not prevent occupancy by domestic servants of different race, if such domestic servants be actually employed by the owner or tenant of the premises, occupied by them." Unquote. These words are copied from a deed of restrictions of a home right here in Midland. By the 21st century, we would have learned that even after Civil War, it took over 100 years for our black brothers and sisters to have the unhindered right to vote, own a home of their choosing in the neighborhood of their choice, drink from the same water fountain as their white brethren, and choose their seats on the bus. We would know that these vestiges of our history were not to be remembered through the honoring of a person who fought to keep certain races separate from the inherent blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By the 21st century, most of us would have had meaningful and honest conversations with our black friends in an effort to understand what the exaltation of the South and the memory of Dixie actually felt like to them. They would tell us stories of fathers and grandfathers who had to search out places they could live, segregated schools to attend, and water fountains to drink from. We would then begin to feel a little of what it might feel like to celebrate the rebel spirit and the Lee heritage and history rooted in a past dedicated to limited access to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the end, our fictional committee would not choose Robert E. Lee as a school namesake and icon. Which leads me to the title of my article, If We Had It to Do Over. And the answer to the question, if given another chance, is simple. No, we would not choose Robert E. Lee. Time and hindsight often lend themselves to what eventually becomes wisdom. And sometimes, after time and history has passed us by, we get a chance to ask ourselves the same questions in another time and the rare opportunity to choose the better answer given time and history. This is not a matter of canceling culture. This is not a matter of taking away someone's history, memories, and pride. This is a time of realizing that the right action of today should have been the right action of yesterday, and that this day we get to do it over for all the right reasons. I am fully aware that some of my dearest and nearest friends will always disagree with my stance on this issue. But through conversations with my friends, black and white, I am certain that if we had the chance to do it over, we would choose a different path. And if right is right today, then it should have been right yesterday. Let's chart a new day in history while never forgetting that which we should cherish of our past. And when we disagree on this matter, let us display our common Midland legacy to love and honor one another rather than disparage online, in public, and in private. After all, if it's honor we are pursuing, then that is displayed in how we treat each other in our most heated disagreements. Education. IDEA has recruited and is ready to go. Teachers coming from all over for Travis's first year. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. When IDEA public schools officials announced their partnership with Midland ISD and plans to bring as many as 10 schools to Midland and Odessa, they said they were not going to take from an already thin pool of teachers. And less than 3 weeks before the first day of school at their first campus, IDEA Travis Academy, officials can say, mission accomplished. IDEA officials told the Reporter-Telegram that of the 80 staff members at the Southeast Midland campus, nearly 3 out of 4 are from outside the region, and only 7 staff members previously worked for Midland ISD. Staff members are coming to Midland from San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth, the Rio Grande Valley, Lubbock, Houston, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Chicago, Georgia, Alabama, Washington, and Delaware. One staff member will come from Belize, according to the information provided to the Reporter-Telegram. Bethany Salas, executive director of IDEA Public Schools in the Permian Basin, said IDEA is aggressive in its recruiting. For IDEA's Midland campus, the organization is offering staff members a housing stipend of $500 a month and one-time relocation payment. However, these primarily new teachers are committed to IDEA's mission of closing inequities in education and are excited about being part of a turnaround project like Travis, which will come into the 2020-21 school year with one of the longest failing streaks in the state, 5 straight years. It was the challenge that played a role in bringing Executive Principal Haley McCarthy to Midland. She was, as Sala said, the highest performer within a high-performing organization. The Texas Education Agency rated her former campus, IDEA South Flores in San Antonio, as an A campus in 2019 and provided the school with marks of 93 and 94 the last 2 years. Haley is a phenomenal leader, Sala said. When you talk with her, you want to work for her. The IDEA partnership with Midland ISD has started with more fanfare than the district's relationships with other charter schools. It might be because of the $55 million in local philanthropy that is expected to help launch a greater IDEA presence in Midland, Odessa. It could be IDEA's record. 6 IDEA schools in the Rio Grande Valley, 3 of which are in Brownsville, Mission, San Juan, and Edinburgh, are among the top 33 high schools in the state, according to U.S. News & World Report. Whatever the reason, Sala said IDEA Travis Academy received at least 1,400 applicants. The number of students registered for the first year of IDEA Travis as of 1 week ago was 791, according to Sala. What's also exciting is that almost 500 of those students attended Travis last year, Sala said. Students are choosing to stay at Travis, which is really meaningful to us because that's why we wanted to partner with MISD. This is a really important neighborhood school with rich history in the community. And our first priority is making sure that students that have been in a failing school for most of the past many years are now in a very different school with a very different outcome. Solace, a former teacher and principal in the IDEA network, went one step further and said, IDEA Travis will be a proof point for what any child can do. She talked about the academic achievement that's possible. Not the scaled scores of 50 overall, 46 in student achievement, 58 in school progress, or 30 in closing the gaps Travis had in 2019. Their background, their former academic achievement, does not matter, Salas said. We've done it at a lot of other IDEA schools across the state, and we will do it again. But it will be impossible to argue that it's the fault of the children or the neighborhood or the families. No, it's on us, the adults in the system, to get it right. And these are children that deserve to have a school that gets it right. IDEA Travis is still scheduled to begin August 11th, more than 1 week before Midland ISD's other schools. Travis families can choose to have in-person or virtual instruction, Salas said. In each option, we are thinking about academic excellence. So whether you're in person or online, you are working toward really highly rigorous academic goals, achieving those and being rewarded for them just like we've always done. Those attending in person will have plexiglass around their desk that provides a cubicle feel. It also will be expected that students and teachers wear masks in the common areas. Students will have recess and will be able to run and play, but in ways that limits exposure to coronavirus. It's important for children to be able to recognize each other and make friends, and that's a big reason that many families are choosing to send their children back in person. They want them to be with their friends, and you know, pediatricians are saying the same thing. Ultimately, it puts the choice in the hands of families, and then it's on us to provide access. Quotes from are provided by IDEA Public Schools about what people say about IDEA Travis. I chose IDEA after a while of working at a regular ISD. I wanted to be part of something bigger than I myself. I read about IDEA's mission, and I was so excited about a system who sincerely cares about all students, not only going to college, but being successful throughout the entire journey. I chose to move to Midland after speaking to Principal Haley McCarthy. I was so inspired by Ms. McCarthy. Her determination, flexibility, and creativity captivated me, and I knew I had to be part of her team. The kids at Travis deserve to have a staff who love them and who will do anything to help them meet their goals. I want to be part of that staff. Jeanette Torres, who is moving from El Paso to teach science at IDEA Travis. I chose to work at IDEA because here I am surrounded by leaders that share my vision for equity, my belief that every single student has a right to a quality education and the capacity to help students achieve the greatness within them. Thanks to the families and community at IDEA Travis, we have an opportunity to build something great. I have not been here long, but this community has been beautiful and welcoming in my time here. I believe I speak for the whole staff when I say I feel privileged to work in the Travis community. Let's get to work. Solomon Jordan, who is moving to Midland from Atlanta to teach English language arts at IDEA Travis. I was blessed with the opportunity to serve as principal of IDEA South Flores Academy for the last 7 years. The experience taught me that all children can be successful when the adults in the building get it right. The children at Travis Elementary have struggled academically, and so has the school. I decided to move to Midland to open IDEA Travis because the children at Travis Elementary deserve to attend a great school and experience success. Principal Haley McCarthy.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.